Thank you for that introduction and for the opportunity to speak on this topic with y'all today. I have, for my disclosures, no relevant financial relationships to disclose. This is a brief overview slide just to tell you a little bit. I'll talk about some background and significance, some of which has been mentioned in terms of diabetic retinopathy, and then go through some our study goals, methods, results, discussion, and a little bit about our ongoing and future work in this area. So, as mentioned, diabetic retinopathy is damage to the blood vessels of the retina and is the leading cause of blindness in working-age Americans. It's also truly an epidemic in the safety net in America. A large study of Latinos in Los Angeles showed that a prevalence of this disease was close to 50%. However, it's a treatable disease. One of the landmark studies in ophthalmology, the early treatment of diabetic retinopathy study, showed that effective treatment can reduce severe vision loss from this disease by up to 94%. However, at least 40 to 45% of diabetics who could benefit from earlier detection and treatment of retinopathy don't receive it. This slide, I think, is particularly potent from the National Eye Institute just to sort of put us in the position of what it's like to be a patient with diabetic retinopathy. Even if we're providers and on the other end of it, we don't often see what it's like to see through their eyes, and it truly is a crippling disease. So that brings home its importance in public health and the importance for screening for this. In general, the U.S. screening rates for diabetic retinopathy are approximately 60%. They're not amazing, but at least we're reaching the majority of patients. However, the U.S. Inner city safety net clinic screening rates are actually quite abysmal. We're less than 25%. Some factors that actually impact this disparity are a shortage of specialists for retinopathy screening in these areas. Again, there's often shortage of specialists in these areas, and a large number of uninsured or underinsured patients. And then there's the patient misconceptions about utility of regular eye examinations. Because diabetic retinopathy can be an asymptomatic disease until very far along, patients often don't realize or are not aware that they need to come in sooner, and actually until they have bleeding in their eyes, this doesn't even enter into their radar. So the historical screening process for diabetic retinopathy in the Los Angeles safety net is that diabetic patients are seen at a primary care clinic in their federal qualified health center or federal qualified health center lookalike, and then referred into a county health facility for their routine retinopathy screening. Then usually 6 to 9 months or more, sometimes upwards of a year after that referral is placed, the patient is then screened by an eye care provider at this county health facility and given follow-up as needed. Sometimes there's actually the additional step if that person happened to be screened at an outside county health facility, outside the med center, and they need to be referred in for treatment. There's an extra referral that can happen, say, from optometry to ophthalmology, and add on even more time to patients that could be that need treatment and therefore are going blind quickly. So a potential solution to this problem is in teleretinal screening, and that's digital non-mydriatic camera images have been shown to be effective for diabetic retinopathy screening. Studies have shown a high sensitivity and specificity of this technology when compared to examinations by an eye care provider and also to the standard of care of 7 standard field retinal photography images. Examples of places that have implemented this successfully are the Veterans Affairs Healthcare System, Joslin Vision Network, and Indian Health Services, all of which have published on this. So with retinal image uploads and secure web-based image viewing software, off-site specialists can actually assess risk asynchronously using store and forward telemedicine technologies to then evaluate patients and grade their diabetic retinopathy. Two of the images here are just an example of what you get with teleretinal screening. One is a normal fundus and the other is proliferative diabetic retinopathy and also potentially a little bit of a cataract there. This is an example of the camera, one of the cameras, which is a Canon. This in particular is a Canon digital non-mydriatic camera, of which there are several makes and models. And you can see it can fit easily into a primary care clinic. Our study goals were to assess the barriers to and facilitators of using teleretinal screening to detect diabetic retinopathy in 6 of our South Los Angeles safety net clinics. These were FQHCs. We wanted to look at image quality, the proportion of images that were readable, and actually how acceptable teleretinal screening is to patients and the clinic staff in terms of integration into the system. And we also looked to determine the proportion of diabetic patients at risk for retinopathy who both receive retinal screening in accordance with the evidence-based guidelines and then require and receive ophthalmologic treatment. We signed an MOU between the clinics and the Charles Drew University Center for Biomedical Informatics. Charles Drew University agreed to purchase three of the digital non-mydriatic cameras for use in screening. Others were provided by their grants and through the clinics. They retained 3 board-certified ophthalmologists as readers. We arranged for photography training and retraining and certification as needed, as well as weekly monitoring of clinical sites and troubleshooting. The reason the last part of the MOU here is in blue is because this was actually arranging with the county clinics to expedite treatment for the potential cases of moderate or worse retinopathy wasn't actually part of the MOU at the beginning because it wasn't realized that we would need that until we actually got in there and realized that the referral systems were so bad we couldn't have patients waiting that we had screened in this new manner couldn't be waiting in that same line, that same queue for 6 to 9 months or upwards of a year. So we needed to arrange a workaround to actually expedite their care. The clinics then agreed to provide staff, medical assistants, all were, to be trained on the camera use, as well as, and the photographers took and uploaded these retinal images into the software we use, the IPAC software system, and made referrals to the county health facilities, as well as provided access to their medical records for extraction. The patients were screened for the gradation levels here listed of diabetic retinopathy from mild through severe, non-proliferative, as well as proliferative disease, as well as clinically significant macular edema, and also for other conditions. As these were ophthalmologist and eye care provider screeners, we were able to assess for other conditions, some of which are listed here. Photographers were medical assistants, again, as I mentioned before, working at the clinics, and they received training on using the cameras from our collaborator, Dr. Quadros, who was the creator of the IPAC software, actually out of UC Berkeley. But the photographers had to be certified before taking pictures of actual patients. So they took 10 sets of retinal images of non-patients that were uploaded beforehand, and the images had to be graded satisfactory by IPAC staff. The readers were 3 board-certified ophthalmologists to assess the retinal images through the IPAC's web-based software. There were 6 to 8 images of each eye, and then after reviewing, readers then check boxes indicating the presence or absence of clinical characteristics, of which I've listed some here. And then the overall severity level of the retinopathy, or absence thereof, is computed by an algorithm based into the software. However, readers can override that computer assessment and manually enter a different one as determined by their clinical judgment. They also graded the quality of the images taken by the medical assistants or the photographers, and these were the options of what they could choose to grade how the results of the images, all the way from insufficient for any interpretation at all to an excellent image. And comments were also able to be provided in the text box. And so additional data is, again, in addition to the images that were taken from 2010 to 2011, there was a retrospective chart abstraction ongoing at the same time but ended a bit later in September 2012, where we abstracted patient demographics, history of the medical visit, including the specialist other specialist referrals as well as for eye care, comorbid conditions, and clinical values at multiple time points, of which I've listed here. So the clinic characteristics of the 6 clinics, most notably, if you can tell from this slide, the majority of the patient population is Hispanic, and this is characteristic of Los Angeles Safety Net. This was the case in all the clinics that the majority was Hispanic, except for one. And that clinic actually had a majority of a non-Hispanic black. The overall estimated amount of diabetics in these 6 clinics, which are a coalition, is 9,432. And this is an estimate, as the data on these clinics, as the population they serve is so great that it isn't always accurate, which we learned actually during the study. Out of the total number of diabetic, again, total estimated number of diabetics at these clinics, the total number of unique patients that we screened was 2,732. That's approximately 30% of the patients there. Now, the total number of those patients recommended for referral to a specialist is about 38%. And that includes all referrals. So as you can see here, that's also including other conditions recommended for referral, which may be non-urgent, cataract, et cetera. However, about 9.6 of that were flagged for expedited referral. And those are patients including the proliferative diabetic retinopathy, severe NPDR, and clinically significant macular edema, as they may be needing treatment. So an important point from this slide is that 62% of patients actually were determined to have no disease and were removed from the queue waiting for appointments with eye care providers, and therefore did not increase the wait times for others that may need eye care provider evaluation and treatment. The image quality ratings, the data is here for this in this table, and as you can see, the majority are adequate and above, and that's what's desirable. Now, if you add insufficient for full interpretation, in which a full interpretation can't be made, but a diagnostic recommendation often still can from that data, then that number increases even more. But interestingly, if you look at the number that are ungradable, which is insufficient for any interpretation, there's a decent variety among the clinics that some, you know, are up to 13% that are ungradable, whereas others could be low as 4%. So in discussing these findings, I mentioned that while our screening rate was above the norm for what published literature finds for any inner-city clinics, it wasn't as good as we'd hoped it would be. Some of that is the data of the baseline of diabetics that are at these clinics, that 9,432 number. We had no way of knowing whether or not these were actually active diabetic patients. These were just one-time visits that had been seen within the last 2 years, so they may not be even patients of those clinics anymore, and that was the best baseline data that we could get. The other factor is that technology isn't everything, and so there were workflow issues, there were other reasons that these patients were not able to obtain the screening that we intended for them. So looking at the barriers to teleretinal screening became an important thing for us, and some of it is the clinics currently lack resources to integrate the image taking into the primary care visits. Patient had to return for visits, that increases your no-show rate, and so the ideal is to integrate it within the primary care visit, but as we experienced, that's not always possible. Patients sometimes didn't understand the reason for their screening visit. Again, the asymptomatic plays into this, but also education and communication within the clinic. And also there was a need for image quality rating cutoff for photographers, which we actually developed during the course of the study, as we didn't realize the importance of that to set out beforehand. And that was also part and parcel with needing to designate clinic staff responsible for coordinating camera refreshing training and image quality control, to really kind of pay attention to this QA throughout the process, as that increases the number of gradable images, and therefore the number effectively screened. Sorry, I went back and forth. And so some of the facilitators that we noted were having proactive photographers, a clinical environment that really rewarded photographer creativity and troubleshooting, and working around these kind of workflow issues, also acknowledging the importance of screening by staff that were not involved in the study, and providing incentives for photographers to maintain and improve upon those skills. All of this was very critical to ensure in the primary care side that this worked. In terms of image quality, we did notice that the image quality improved over time. There was a learning curve. And also clinics that screened patients several times a week or more saw greater improvements in image quality than those that were screening more sporadically. So in terms of our ongoing work, we actually are looking at more of these workflow issues with an analysis of our qualitative data, the impact on workflow, as well as our patient perceptions with focus groups that we did. And we also had in-depth interviews that were done with clinical staff, medical directors, and the ophthalmologist graders, all of which we will look at for barriers and facilitators to this intervention. We also are looking at analysis of our data from the retrospective chart abstraction, which just recently ended, both in the clinical correlates and machine learning, of which I'll explain a little bit more about on the next slide. So in terms of future work, we would like to look more at other factors that are impacting the screening rate, in addition to the technology, as I mentioned before. One of that is the use of assessing the use of promotoras, or community health workers, and that impact on the screening rate to really improve patient outreach in our communities. And then to speak a little bit more about that machine learning, we look at a predictive model for patients that are at risk of retinopathy, and that is essentially using bioinformatics methods to look back at our clinical data that was abstracted and correlate that with our screening diagnosis results and see if we can use that to improve patient outreach by identifying and targeting patients that are most vulnerable for developing diabetic retinopathy. And we're also looking to identify biomarkers associated with diabetic retinopathy in different populations in collaboration with our basic scientists at our institution to do that. This is just a citation of some of the up-and-coming, if you will, biomarkers with diabetic retinopathy that we're considering. Keep pressing the other way. And so in terms of acknowledgments, these were a list of people that really made the study possible. The study team is highlighted in blue, and the others were an incredible support in actually getting this to happen all the way from inception to completion. And a note to our funders, as this work was supported in part by a grant from the US NIH. Thank you very much for your time.